Country coach.
Really?
Guys, ready?
Just help out.
Yeah.
Ready or not, here we go.
Test team.
Yeah.
But it was a serious.
Welcome, everybody, to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. For the record, it's May 31st, 2017, and this is our last meeting for the 2017 session. We've got a few things up today. A number of these we may be moving off into rules. They'll still need some more work, but we're going to start off with this one, isn't it? The Interstate Bridge.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2750B. So we'll do that. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2750B authorizes, permits the Port of Hood River to establish a toll on bridges over which it has authority to operate and maintain. It authorizes the port to sell and otherwise transfer ownership of any bridge or its approaches that are owned by the port as part of a tollway project. It outlines circumstances under which the port is subject to state contracting processes, prevailing wage rates, land use laws, statutes governing public-private partnerships. This measure came over to the committee, to the Senate, with a House vote of 47-9. It came over with a fiscal impact and a revenue impact. Those are both available on OLIS. For the original bill, there was a work group on this, Mr. Chair. The work group developed, there were two amendments, the dash B5 and B6, that were products of that work group. I believe we're going to have folks that speak to both of those amendments, so I will dispense with the explanation of those and defer to them to do that. I will tell you that we have not received fiscal or revenue impact statements for either of the dash B5 or B6 amendment. Mr.
Okay. Representative Hobie, come on down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for allowing me to go first, as I'm supposed to be in another committee voting on bills at this moment. But I really felt it important to come down and talk just a little bit, even though I hear you're probably going to send this bill on to rules. I come as a proponent and an opponent, both wrapped into one. So I've been working pretty hard with the port and Dan Bates and Legislative Council and trying to come to grips with a couple of issues. So I had drafted the B5 last Friday and had been working with the representatives from the port previous to that. They came back and wanted a slightly different draft. A B6, and I'm not sure either one of them is quite correct, though I will tell you that one of the main issues that came before us was making sure that the state's interest was protected if they were to sell this bridge, and so we tried to incorporate some things that were protecting this. And originally the bill came addressing the tolling statutes and trying to put exemptions using those exemptions, and it became apparent to me that this could set a precedent for tolling projects around the state, and so I looked more at the interstate bridge statute, which is 381, is trying to address this issue. It was a much more narrow and much more to the point of the bridge. And one of the issues that rose to the surface was the port's interest in pursuing a public-private partnership, which I think, yeah, as you know, Mr. Chair, we may be seeing more of in the future. So I thought it important to engage ODOT as well in asking them questions. And they haven't been quite as engaged in this bill, but I think they need to be. Definitely, at least for a portion of this bill anyway. So we, the innovative private partnership program that ODOT has is in ORS 367, and in it is an exemption from the public contracting code. However, the prevailing wage must be paid if there's use of public funds in that exemption, and I am fine with that language for the 3P agreement, which I think is represented in the B5 amendment, and it uses that language specifically. But with that caveat comes matching and using some of the rules developed by ODOT, and I can't remember from the statute that had come, 367, 800 or something, that provides, you know, some of the things that must be met to, since they're exempt from public contracting code to ensure accountability, transparency, and making sure the public's interest is protected. So there was a couple of pieces that we wanted to make sure that applied when we entered into a 3P project. I know Dan Bates is coming up a little bit later on the B6, and their particular amendment uses that similar but not quite the same, and you know how that exemption is exactly written. I'm fine with it being written the way it's written in 367. However, in the B6, it appears to me that the exemption applies to the entire section 2 of the bill, which would exempt them from public contracting on any kind of construction, whether it was a private public partnership or not. And I don't know that that was the intent, but that was one of my main objections to the bill at the outset, that, you know, if they're just going to build a bridge, they're a public agency and they're subject to the public contracting code and should proceed as such. But if there's a 3P agreement, I agree that they should be able to use that same exemption that's in the innovative partnership, public-private partnership program that ODOT has, but they need to comply to those rules that ODOT develops around how to protect the public's interest, and since we don't have the public contracting code in place on that point, there's a couple other little issues between the B5 and the B6. And there is a portion in Section 3, Sub 3 that talks about the Department of Transportation entering into an agreement for the tolling enforcement, and there's a bit of disagreement on how that should be structured, and I really don't have a lot of background in that. I really think we should be deferring to ODOT to how they would, you know, be able to enter into that kind of agreement to enforce the tolling piece of that. And there was another piece about following those Department of Transportation rules that were adopted as part of 367, and that, you know, the port would have to substantially conform to that. We tried to, in the B5s, kind of point to what substantially conform might mean, because it seems like it would be kind of ambiguous a little bit. I commend it to your committee to figure this out, or send it to rules and figure it out there, which I hope you will do, because I do believe it's important for the state to enable the Port of Hood River to enter into a public-private partnership to complete a project on this bridge. But just judging from the potential precedent that this project could set for other projects in this state, and how we handle exemptions to the public contracting code in public-private partnerships is really important. And yeah, I think it applies there, but not necessarily in the tolling statutes, and not necessarily for, you know, local governments being able to just exempt themselves from the public contracting code entirely. So that is where I'm at. We actually, you will notice a lot of similarities in the B6 and the B5, came a long ways in agreement. There's just a couple little sticking points that I'm sure with your brain power in the Rules Committee, we'll be able to get this over the finish line. And if I can be of further assistance, and the court can disagree with whether I'm assistance or not, but I think we've come to pretty close to a good product, but I do ask you, if you have questions specifically about what these amendments do, to ask Legislative Council. And I would commend that, you know, ODOT should be in this conversation. They had a different approach to this, which our work groups, you know, sort of walked away from a little bit without giving it too much consideration, just because the port was really uncomfortable about having to go back and explain, you know, why we're entering in a whole different set of statutes to accomplish this. I think it can be accomplished in ORS 381, and hope it's something that you can figure out.
The good news and the bad news is that we have a few more weeks that we can work on this.
Thank you very
questions
much.
Questions of the representative? Senator?
Yes, if I tie you up with lots of questions, it will prevent you from voting. I think I have a list of 47 questions.
I do not yield.
Thank you, Representative. All righty, Michael McElvey?
McElway? Yeah.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
Close. It's pretty close.
McElway,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you. And you pronounced it very close to accurate. Michael McElway, Portahead River Executive Director. I want to start out by saying I've never testified in front of a committee that has had a member that's driven across the Hood River Bridge and probably knows more about it than I do and anybody in the room, and that's Senator Thompson. So, Senator, thank you for your help and support of this bill, as is with Representative Johnson. I'm here to talk about HB 2750, what was approved by the House and moved on to the Senate. And I want to talk about the critical need that we face as a special district, as a port authority in the state, to make sure that this bridge is maintained, its connectivity to the other side of the river, and maintains its role in the economy in the mid-Columbia. I want to start out by simply saying for all of you on the committee, thank you for your efforts on a statewide transportation bill. Our board is very much in support of your efforts and in making sure that a bill like that happens. Thank you. We think that this bridge is a key piece of transportation infrastructure that's connected to an interstate freeway on one side and a state highway on another side, and is equally important, or as important as many around the state. I want to talk about the history of the bridge, and I'll move quickly, but I think it's important to reflect on the fact that this bridge was built in 1924. It was built by a private company, the Oregon-Washington Bridge Company, based on congressional authority granted in 1906. So in some ways, what we're discussing here, and we'll reflect on a bit later, is one of the original public-private partnerships in the state, and one that delivered an interstate bridge to the state of Oregon and Washington. So the toll rate was $1 when it was built. The toll rate is $1 now, for your information. In 1939, the Bonneville Dam went in, which raised the pool level in the behind the dam. And because of that, the Corps of Engineers required the Oregon-Washington Bridge Company to build a lift span, and they provided funds to do so. So there was a significant amount of work that was constructed in 1939 and 1940. And so when the dam was in and the pool was up, there was an operable bridge. Now, this one raised and lowered because it needs to accommodate river traffic. In about 1949, the state authorized local governments, including port authorities, to own and operate interstate bridges. And that was litigated, and it went through a Supreme Court case and was concluded. In 1950, the Port of Hood River purchased the Hood River Bridge after the Oregon-Washington Bridge Company offered it to the state of Oregon, to the state of Washington, to counties on either side of the river, to cities on either side of the river, and port authorities in the area. There was only one agency that stepped up and offered to and ultimately purchased the bridge, and that was the Port of Hood River. It was purchased for $800,000. The port has operated it successfully for 67 years since that time. And since that time, we've invested over $40 million into the bridge. And every year, about $1 million in capital expenditures goes in. This is a very, very important and critical link in our economy to both sides of the river in the mid-Columbia. In 2006, we established an electronic tolling system for this bridge. We have 10 years of experience in ETC tolling. We have over 12,000 accounts, and we're currently investing over $1 million into an upgraded system that will include license plate recognition, way-in-motion technology, and interoperability with the states of Washington, California, and ultimately other western states through the latest chip technology, C6. So we are in some ways an example of a local agency using the means it has and creative thought and effort to maintain a major piece of infrastructure. We're here to ask for your help looking down the road. So why should we replace this bridge? Why should we care about it? As I said, major portions of it are nearly 80 years old. Some portions are 92 years old. It's a very old bridge. It's functionally obsolete. The lane widths are 9 feet 4 and 7.5 inches. It's weight restricted, 80,000 pounds. A lot of the rigs you see on the freeways are 105,000. The regional fruit, regional timber, even some of the trucks that access in situ and companies across the river need that bridge, and their trucks exceed that weight limit. There's no bicycle pedestrian facilities. It's a very significant bottleneck when there's an emergency, and every year on average we have one closure of the gorge that requires that bridge to become part of the interstate highway system. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, 105,000 rigs plus are crossing the bridge nose to tail, even though it's a weight limit of 80,000, and we accommodate them. It's regarded as the most hazardous obstacle on the entire inland waterway system. From Florida to the ports of Clarkston and Lewiston, you ask a river pilot, they'll tell you that is the worst place to get through. Narrow opening and a lot of wind and weather challenges there. And maybe most important, and what keeps me up at night, is that it's seismically deficient. It's not only a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake, but if it's 8.5 or 9 out in the Pacific, it's 6.5 when it gets to Hood River. That'll take down that bridge, and it'll block the channel, and it'll block the north-south connectivity. There's also local faults around Mount Hood that drive smaller earthquakes, but nevertheless ones that could bring portions of that bridge down. So it's nearing the end of its life. And as a representative of the elected board of the Port of Hood River, who feel strongly that it's our responsibility to take any action we can, look at any possible approach to replacement of that bridge, we seek the tools that we need to follow up on that and take those next steps forward. These are long-term projects. It won't happen overnight, but we need to take that next step to replace it within the 10 to 15 year period. So, briefly, what's been done to date: draft environmental impact statement, type, size, and location study, some geotechnical assessment, so we have characterized the underlying geology to a large extent. It's been named on the critical rural freight network for the state of Washington. Unsure if that will be so designated by the state of Oregon. In the FAST Act, we were able to work with our congressional delegation to get an amendment that specifically calls out projects in national scenic areas as being eligible for FAST Lane program funding, and we have submitted a FAST Lane grant to the federal government. So I'm going to skip over this section a little bit, but just say that there's the strongest possible message I can convey to you is that we need to maintain as many possible options as at this point as we can. We need to open that door as wide as possible. And generally speaking, there's a typical publicly funded approach, and probably that's the approach that this bridge replacement may need to take. Design, bid, build, public funding that aggregates together and builds a new bridge. The other approach, which does have some possibility here, is the public-private partnerships, or P3. We need to make sure that the door is open wide enough to possibly accommodate those kinds of approaches. So what we have done here with House Bill 2750 that came across is, we believe, provide that kind of clarity, that kind of specificity, and those kind of tools. It clarifies the port's statutory authorities to own and operate an interstate bridge. That's a crucial piece. It importantly conveys what we believe ODOT already has, what the legislature has already designated to your State Department of Transportation to enable a P3 types partnerships. Tollways are in 383 and innovative partnerships in 367. Those tools have already been handed to the Department of Transportation. What the Port of Hood River seeks are those same tools, very analogous to what already exists. And we need to be able to engage in an agreement with ODOT to enforce tolling for people that don't pay. So we made two big commitments, important commitments, when it was being considered by the House. One is that we agreed to work closely with Representative Holvey to address his ideas and his concerns. We've done so in multiple work sessions. We've done so with multiple conversations and drafts. And unfortunately, the Dash 5 and Dash 6 amendments in front of you, as Representative Holvey said, aren't quite there. Second, we agreed, we are a public agency. We are bound by public contracting rules and regulations. And we have a local contract review board, as do other ports and special district are like ours. What we agreed to do, which makes perfect sense, is to enact as an LCRB similar rules to enable a P3 partnership as ODOT already has. We've made that commitment as well. So I want to emphasize one thing with a public-private partnership. The reason why the words are important and the specific terms are important is because what's important with a private partner is clarity. To the extent there isn't clarity, to the extent there's ambiguity, it raises the risk, and that risk profile accrues to the public partner or you pay for it. So clarity is important. We believe that the legislation in 367 and in 383 provide that clarity, and we are seeking the same. So we're asking for your help in this. I would be happy to go through aspects of each bill or each possible amendment, but I think the nut of it is that these aren't quite there yet. We need to work together to get them there, but I want to emphasize how important it is that we maintain some momentum here and seeking your help to do that. If it has to be through the Rules Committee, then so be it. We believe the legislation that came across is adequate and clear, and it's what we would we think is appropriate. If it needs to be modified, we want to work with you to do that. If I could add, Mr. Chair, just one more thing. If we don't have these kind of tools, we have to look to the other scenario. If we don't have these kind of tools available to us, we don't walk away from the bridge. We never will. But what we have to do is make sure that the money that we have goes back in the current bridge and we keep it going as long as possible. And that long as possible may be a decade or so. But eventually that bridge will fall. It'll be hit by a barge. It'll come down, or it'll be damaged to the extent that we cannot maintain that connection. The only other tool we have in our toolbox is reducing the weight limit, and we could do that. Senator Thompson drives a fruit truck at 80,000 pounds. We could drop it to 8,000 pounds. That could keep the bridge going longer. So there are some ways to prolong this, but we cannot walk away from the fact that that's nearing a 100-year-old bridge. We need to do something. Thank you.
That bridge is very important. There's a really nice pub on the other side of the river. In all seriousness, I think they're clearly the intent, at least of I think our committee, is that we recognize the need to do that. It's just a question of making sure that we got the language right. I guess I would ask one question, and that's I've always been of the understanding that the P3 statute that we have applies equally to local governments, including ports, as it does to the state. And I'm curious why we need to change that, in your opinion.
Well, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not the expert at it, but if you look at 367, there are multiple provisions that relate to the Department of Transportation. So decision making winds through the OTC. There's provisions that relate to certain conditions that they have or requirements that they have that aren't appropriate. So what we attempted to do, and I thought we did fairly well in 2750, is we took the aspects of 367 and 383 that were most appropriate and appropriate for a port authority. And for example, we don't address rest areas, whereas ODOT's would. We thought we took across what was fair and appropriate and reasonable, but not all the others that were extraneous.
Makes a lot of sense. I understand that, particularly in the current era of federal funding, your chances of getting federal funding without doing some form of 3P are appear to be limited
it
at
looks
this
that
time.
Way, yes, sir.
So I appreciate that. I am concerned, and I will be candid, that I have not gone through the bill, that we don't inadvertently create some changes in our bidding rules that will affect other projects. So I want to be careful about that, and I think that's one of the things we do have a little more time to make sure that. And Senator Thompson has offered to lead a work group to kind of work through that a little bit more. And we do have some time. We don't have the paperwork to pass today anyway.
Yes.
And so we will be moving it to rules. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate you making the trip down.
Again.
Huh?
Again.
Well, you know, comes with the turf. Okay, so Travis.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Travis Brower. I'm the assistant director of ODOT, and I oversee the Office of Innovation, in which the Oregon Innovative Partnership Program is located. ODOT really isn't negatively impacted by this bill in any way, and so we're here really just to offer our expertise on public-private partnerships and help inform the discussion. We do have some experience in this area. What we've seen is that in some cases, public-private partnerships can have significant benefits. They can reduce life cycle costs for infrastructure through innovative private sector innovation and financing, and they can help to manage risk by assigning the risks to the people who can best manage those risks. However, they are inherently complex transactions that involve a number of potential risks that have to be managed appropriately. What we've seen across the country and here in Oregon as well is that public-private partnership authority should be broad enough to allow for innovation and for mutual benefit by the public and private sectors. But experience also shows that that authority needs to come with clear requirements to manage risk and ensure public accountability. As already discussed, ODOT has a public-private partnership procurement authority established under statute in 367.800. It's known as the Oregon Innovative Partnership Program. It generally waives most public contracting requirements while setting sideboards for contracting under the statute. It was a statute that was created by the legislature after much deliberation to allow for innovation in contracting by offering potential benefits in terms of risk and cost as we undertake these projects through these innovative methods, while also balancing those potential benefits against that need to manage risk, ensuring that the ultimate responsibility for the project remains with the public sector, and setting ground rules for transparency and accountability. For example, the OIPP statute requires that agreements with the private sector must do a number of things. They have to specify how the partners will share management of the project risks. They have to specify how the partner will allocate financial responsibility for cost overruns. And they also have to include penalties for non-performance and incentives for performance. These are all critical factors in a successful PPP. I believe that those were provisions that weren't included in the original bill, 2750, but now are included in the B6 amendment. We've taken this OIPP statute out for a number of test drives, although we have not yet used it for any major projects. We did explore using it for tollway projects back in 2007, 2008, and we found it has been proven to work, and we have actually used it to deliver some small-scale electric vehicle charging infrastructure where it was the most appropriate contracting method to partner with the private sector to have them install, operate, and maintain charging stations using federal grants. As noted before, the port could use the OIPP authority, which would involve coming through the Oregon Transportation Commission as essentially the public body that has authority to grant that approval to enroll the project in a program. In discussions with the port as part of this work group, we had suggested essentially lifting the OIPP statute and specifically applying it to the port under the interstate bridge provisions within ORS 381. In conclusion, the authority that's granted by HB 2750 represents a significant policy decision for the state of Oregon at a time when the federal government is considering steps that would encourage use of public-private partnerships to deliver important projects. The bill creates a model for granting jurisdiction procurement authority exempt from the public contracting code, which would make it easier for other jurisdictions to request the same authority from the legislature. What we've seen in the past is that the effort to develop public-private partnerships will benefit from creating a clear legal and regulatory framework that manages risk appropriately, ensures responsibility remains ultimately with the public sector, and sets ground rules that encourage transparency. Given that we've seen two new amendments that came out last night, it seems appropriate to spend some time in the weeks to come working through these nuances, and ODOT is happy to offer our expertise and our experience to the committee and legislature in working through these issues.
Travis, I'm trying to remember. The only one that I can think of that was big was, wasn't the airport leg of the MAX trains, wasn't that at the P3?
Chair Beyer, yes. The airport MAX light rail project was a public-private partnership that TriMet entered into with Bechtel Corporation. There are many different types of public-private partnerships. On the roadway side, we usually talk about toll-based public-private partnerships in which a concession is granted to a private firm that designs, builds, finances, operates, and maintains the route using toll revenue. But there are alternate methods. For example, there's what is known as availability payments, where you don't need to use tolls. You simply pay on a set basis the public or the private partner from public funds. In the case of the Airport Way MAX, I believe that was an exchange for development rights to land that was available. And so,
what authority was it done under? Was it done under the ODOT authority?
Chair Beyer, I'm not certain of that. I do not believe that that was the authority that that was entered into at that time.
So am I in error? I thought local governments had the authority to do P3s on their own now.
Chair Beyer, there are local governments would be generally subject to the contracting statutes. There may be opportunities within those to do public-private partnerships. What the OIPP statute specifically does is generally allows ODOT to bring a private sector partner in early in the development process, exempt from some of the public contracting requirements for competition in those areas. Because what we've found is that the opportunity to leverage private sector innovation comes from bringing a partner in very early so that they are engaged in the development of the project. They can be looking for innovative design opportunities. The example I heard that it may be a good one, it was in British Columbia, where the public sector originally came up with a concept for developing a hospital. They said, well, it can only be two stories because of the underlying soil type. The private sector came in and said, no, we can do this, and we can actually fit it onto a smaller footprint of land and save substantial money. We'll take that risk. If it doesn't work, you don't pay us. And so that's where if you bring the private sector into at an early stage, you're able to have them bring those innovative approaches, innovative financing and design into the mix. That's what the OIPP statute allows us to do.
Okay. Well, I guess the other concern we're going to have a little time is I appreciate if you guys, if you haven't, make sure that the structure that we're looking at doesn't inadvertently mess something else up.
Chair Beyer, we'd be happy to look at that. Having played around in the tollway and interstate bridge statutes in the past, there are certainly opportunities for messing other things up when you do that.
Having spent an interim working on contracting, I can see where that can happen. Other questions? Thank you, Travis. David, did you want to talk on this one?
Yeah.
Okay. Come on down.
Mr. Chairman and legislature, my name's David Beam. I'm a spokesman for disability people in the state of Oregon. And I really like the bill because a lot of disability people in the different districts do ride the get across the bridges in the state of Oregon. You get to work and get home. Some of those bridges is falling apart. So I was wondering if the legislature would give me some funding for each county will have some bridges fixed now. Because way back in the 50s and 60s, the bridges are really bad. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, Oregon do need to fix this as soon as possible. Every governor wanted it done. Some governors didn't want it, the funding for it. So I was thinking if we can get bigger funds and state funds and get these done as soon as possible this year or next year after, 2 years down the line. Then we have money. Because the lottery got a lot of money. Don't get pitch in, too. So all each county would pitch in and get these done for jobs in the state.
Thank you, David. Appreciate your coming forward.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any questions of David? Seeing none? Okay.
Thank you.
Anybody else wish to comment on this? We'll move it to rules. Say, we'll close public hearing. We'll open work session on House Bill 2750.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, we should clarify that this would be a request to refer the bill to rules, and the motion should indicate we're requesting a referral to rules.
Got that? We're requesting a referral to rules? I think that will happen since the president requested it.
Oh. Okay.
You got it?
So, Mr. Chairman,
uh-huh.
I move House Bill 2750 to the floor with a due pass.
Reclamation.
Oh, what am I supposed to say?
That's right.
Yeah.
And request referral to rules.
A request referral to rules.
I don't like the last part.
Senator Thompson has moved House Bill 2750B to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation and requests the President's office to refer it to rules, subsequent referral to rules. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, it's done. All righty. Now, let's see. We want to go here, right?
Yes.
So we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3268A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3268A creates the Oregon Telephone Assistant Program Advisory Committee, directs the Public Utility Commission to use surcharge monies from the Telephone Assistant Program on marketing and outreach to increase participation in the assistance plan developed by the Commission. This measure has no fiscal minimal fiscal, no revenue impact. We also have a dash A3 amendment, Mr. Chair, that clarifies that the operative dates or appeal dates in the measure are triggered when the participation reaches 26%. The bill as written says increases by 26%, but this would be increases to 26%, Mr. Chair. With the dash A3, it has a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
Representative, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee, I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. I wanted to describe briefly the 3268A, the Lifeline Phone Program Task Force. This bill and the task force aims to increase utilization of the federal phone lifeline program for struggling families in Oregon. The program provides phones to Medicaid members, many of whom are homeless, to connect them to services. This bill came from Care Oregon, who brought it forward on behalf of the Oregon Health Plan clients that it represents. Having these phones allows healthcare providers to remind patients of their appointments, reach patients who are trying to quit smoking with the Text to Quit program, and helps patients with diabetes support their daily glucose levels, and helps pregnant patients report and control their glycemic levels. The House Healthcare Committee heard passionate testimony from citizens who came to let us know how vital this phone was in their lives. A homeless gentleman fighting addiction who called his phone his sponsor because when he needed to reach his peer counselor, he was able to make that contact and stay on the path to recovery. A social worker from the Union Gospel Mission who helps people sign up and sees how these phones literally give people a lifeline to family and critical resources and often a way to get back off the streets. Now they have a phone number to give an employer and a housing application. Although the phones are provided free with federal support, Oregon has one of the lowest utilization rates with only 17% of eligible people receiving them. After discussions with Care Oregon, the PUC, the Citizens Utilities Commission, and Oregon Association of the Deaf, and the Governor's Office, there was a group consensus to establish the 9-person Oregon Telephone Assistance Program Advisory Committee to increase utilization of the Lifeline program. The task force will set goals for participation rates in the Oregon Telephone Assistance Program. You just heard that 26% suggested participation rate. Advise the PUC on the eligibility process, a program, and program regulations, including methods to streamline eligibility determinations, improve handset activations, use of Social Security numbers and other identifiers, and examining a comprehensive human service outreach approach. The task force will also review other states' participation rates and processes that increase that participation. It will create a strategic plan to achieve these goals and review annual participation rates, including the change from previous fiscal years. It will recommend budgeting funds for outreach and marketing and for developing partnerships with low-income constituency groups, and finally, coordination between state agencies that serve the targeted populations. 3268A also removes the sunset on the PUC programs that provide assistive telecommunication devices and adaptive equipment for the deaf, which I think you will be hearing more about. I want to thank Martin Taylor, I don't think he's here right now, of CARE Oregon for championing this bill. I want to thank the Brave Consumers for sharing their stories in the House Healthcare Committee and for everyone on the work group who helped reach an agreement on this bill. With those amendments, it passed unanimously out of the House Healthcare Committee and unanimously off the floor of the House, all but the 7% who were excused that day. I'm happy to answer questions.
So the primary goal of this, Representative, is to increase participation in the existing telephone assistance program?
It's actually the Lifeline program.
That's what I meant.
Exactly. So we only have a 17% rate, which I believe is lowest in the country. There's been a lot of things that have come up where if somebody is named Thomas Smith instead of Tom Smith, or Thomas A. Smith instead of Tom Smith, if they have different names, there's been a lot of things that have knocked them out of the eligibility. We also have a very low activation rate. We're not exactly sure why this is so low, but we know that for the people who use it, it's a really, really critical service. So the bill had started out by doing a whole variety of things, disconnecting it for how it's managed now, having it managed just by the federal program, which is how most states do it. We ended up not deciding to go that direction, instead have a task force really look at how to increase utilization.
Questions, Representative? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
And Andrea Salinas.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, members of the committee, on behalf of CARE Oregon, I want to thank you all for indulging us. Martin Taylor has submitted his testimony for the record, and I think Representative Kenny Geyer explained the bill quite well. We want to thank the partners that we worked with at the PUC as well as the other stakeholders. Oh, thank you. Yeah, sorry. For the record, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the lobbyist for CARE Oregon. We just want to thank all the stakeholders that worked with us to get to a place where we could agree on the bill that's before you. And with the Dash A3 amendment, we do support the bill, and it's just a small technical amendment that would bring the rate to 26% and not ask for including an additional 26%. So with that, we would just urge your support of the bill.
Okay. Questions?
What's the current rate, 26%?
The current rate, as Representative Kenny Geyer stated, is 17%. So we would ask for it to be increased up to 26% over 5 years.
Okay. Percent of what?
Oh, I'm sorry. Percent of eligibility.
So this is how do you define that? I'll ask Michael. Any other questions?
I guess I
go ahead.
So what do you see? I mean, I don't know how much money goes into this program. It's like 7 cents, 9 cents a month.
I think Michael knows. I want to say it's around. Yeah.
Okay.
Michael from the PUC knows the exact number.
Other questions?
I guess so. If you you develop this group and advisory committee, and you're gonna. I take it some of this money is going to get used for advertising, outreach, those kind of things that you're not doing now?
I think the idea is that they do some of it now. I think the idea is to better utilize the funds that are being used so that it will be more effective.
Go ahead.
So, I mean, I'm just afraid that you're going to, there's a lot of good things in this program. Lifeline is one of the things. There's three or four others that utilize these funds. So you won't take away funds from the other groups then by doing some of this?
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, that is the intent, is not exactly, it's to not utilize other funds. It's to utilize the funds that are currently there and to make sure that they're utilized properly.
More? Thank you. Michael, you don't get off easy. I want to give us a little broader how the program is structured now.
So, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Michael Daugherty, Chief Operating Officer of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. So to answer some of the questions that were asked, right now the assessment is 7 cents per line and those who have access to the Oregon Relay. We look at that every year. It's been reduced over the last 5 years from 12 cents. It's at 7 cents. We'll look at it again towards the end of the year to see where that needs to move. And I think it will probably move a little bit lower than the 7 cents. Can't guarantee it, but that's the way the numbers are looking. There are three programs under the Residential Service Protection Fund. The first one, what this bill is mainly focused on, is the Oregon Telephone Assistance Program, which takes, it's a combination, we call it Oregon Lifeline, where you have federal funds, 925 coming from the feds, 350 coming from the state of Oregon for those who are eligible for a phone. Now, sometimes the phone is a free phone. There's that option. There are carriers that they do a free phone, it's a cell phone. But it also is used by the landline companies to reduce the cost of the telephone service. So in other words, if you just get landline, your bill is, say, $30 a month, that $12.75 will be used to reduce that bill. So it lowers the, and it makes it more accessible to low income. So that's one of the programs. Our rate is 17%. It really varies from about 5% to 50% throughout the nation. California is about 25%. Some states are lower, some states are higher. You see, most of the states that are higher are either where you have high tribal population or in the southeast, they seem to have a higher rate. The other two programs, one is the Telecommunication Devices Access Program, which allows devices to be loaned to Oregon citizens that have some kind of connection to a telephone. It could be hard of hearing, it could be deaf, it could be vision impaired, it could be mobility impaired, it could be cognitive impaired, that we loan certain telephone equipment that helps them communicate to other people. And then we have the Oregon Relay, which is just basically the 711 that allows, again, deaf, hard of hearing to communicate through different methods to people who can pick up the phone. That's commonly known as the 711. So those are the three programs. Each program in the fund is budgeted separately, so any funds from OTAP will not be taken away from the other two programs.
So what determines eligibility for the Residential Service Protection Fund?
So for the Oregon Lifeline, it's mainly, we mainly look at the SNAP program, because that's the largest program in Oregon as far as low-income assistance. So we look at that. So if a certain population of Oregon is eligible for the SNAP, and then we look at, say, how are we eligible, and that's where we come out to about 16%. And there's reasons for that. But
so I guess I haven't heard. Well, how long has this program been going?
It started actually in the 1980s.
This particular part of it.
Yeah, the Lifeline started in 1980s under President Reagan. The free phone started with President Bush II. So it's been around for a while, and the Oregon program has been around for about 20 years. I have to be exact. I'm not sure if I'm exact on that. It might be a little bit more than 20 years, but it's been around for some time. And it was supposed to sunset in 2010, but it was extended to 2020. And
so I get a follow-up. So we're at 17%. Maybe that's just where we're going to be.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson.
Why do you think it's just 17%? I heard you say the different demographics, but maybe that's just where we're going to be at.
Chair Vice Chair Thompson, that's where we're at. You know, we always want to be challenged. We think we can improve it. The committee, the advisory group, would be used to look at methods, means to improve it. There's a lot of citizens in Oregon who are not aware of the program. I think we need to do a better job of outreach. Go into certain places like Union Gospel Mission and other places to try to improve, because it is important. Telecommunications is important, and
I didn't look. Does this bill have a sunset? So, like, if we do it for 2 or 3 or 4 years, and then we say, hey, it's not working, let's just, we're at 17%, and that's where we're going to be at?
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, actually, yes, we have to report back in the bill in 2022 about our participation rate on an annual basis, starting with 2017, 2018, 19. And basically, if we don't achieve that 26%, then the program is scheduled to sunset in 2023. If we do achieve the 26% or greater than the 26%, then the program's actually extended out to 2030.
So Michael, my memory is such that the PUC operated the program but really didn't advertise the program. We were dependent on Department of Human Resources to do that because the recipients are primarily their clients.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, yes and no. We do a Lifeline Awareness Week, which we try to make it more awareness on it. It's actually the carriers that are supposed to do most of the marketing and for their programs. So you will see sometimes, you'll see advertisements on the TV. But then, yeah, we do work with DHS and with their field offices to try to get, when they enroll somebody into a program like SNAP, or if OHA enrolls somebody in the program like Medicaid, then we work with the two agencies. In fact, we are actually connected to their two databases, and that's one of the ways that we determine eligibility, by using the databases.
So my memory was we had problems when I was at the PUC maintaining eligibility, particularly for those that were on the SNAP program or other forms of public assistance, in terms of trying to figure that out. And I remember at one point we had a private carrier who, in my opinion, was ripping us off big time. So how is that going to work now? Has that changed?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, we do an annual recertification. So we go into the database and to recertify and make sure those who are receiving the benefit are eligible for the benefit. So
how do you do that?
We go through the DHS database. So we check, it's a matter of checking Social Security numbers, checking information back and forth.
So is that a computer tape matchup?
Yeah, it's a computer matchup.
Yeah, it's not a physical look. It's just a...
We do both. But it's mainly computer. But we also, if we think there's an issue or something's not kind of checking out the way it's supposed to, then we'll get more involved manually to see what the issue is, to make sure that someone doesn't lose eligibility that's... should have the eligibility.
And this is both cellular and... Now, my understanding, I'm trying to deal with memory, is the FCC has recently changed some of this as respect to broadband or VoIP phones, and it seems also for cellular phones.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, we have about approximately 29 telecommunications company participate in the program. Three are cellular, AT&T, Consumer Cellular, they participate in the program. And then we have the free phones, who also right now the biggest is really Assurance Wireless, and we're also looking at Access Wireless, and then there's, which is iWireless, in the program. So it is cellular and landline.
These are providers?
Excuse me?
These are specific telephone providers?
Chair Beyer, yes, they are specific. And to your question, yeah, the FCC did have a modernization order that will allow broadband as part of this, so that's all being kind of worked out. So a person can probably choose between if they want the benefit. It's only one benefit per household if they want to apply it to broadband or to the phone, but we're not anywhere near that kind of part with the rules or anything like that yet.
So is that going to create a complication for you in terms of the FCC running some of it and Oregon PUC running others?
there will have to be some alignment going down the road. But right now, I don't see that being too much of a complication.
Okay. Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So OHA and DHS are in the process of redoing their certification process. Is that going to be a problem for you at all?
Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, no. We actually we go through the same, almost the same type of certification as far as the Social Security Administration, which we have like a three-year audit, and we, it's kind of timed together with what goes on with DHS. And I know DHS is working, and I also know that OHA is working on their programs. They're going to do to improve the program they have. I don't think that's going to create an issue for us. Obviously, there's going to have to be some coordination between the agencies, but I think it will pretty much go pretty smoothly.
That sounds good. They aren't really improving the programs that they have. They're really replacing their certification process. That's just starting. Now we're just getting into design phase, really. And so I think that's something you need to keep an eye on if you use their databases for certification.
Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, we certainly will.
Okay. I've lost my memory on this one. Can you get a completely free phone, or is this a discounted phone?
Chair Beyer, on some programs, they can get a free phone. So there are carriers out there that will give a free phone that allows a certain amount of minutes, a certain amount of text. Some of the programs, some of the carriers are now, because of the cost of certain things going down, they will see some data on the phone. So when iWireless really comes into the market, their phones, some of their phone plans will have a small amount of data that will be part of the phone.
So the programs are really whatever the private carriers are willing to offer, and then there's a set amount that the state will subsidize that? Is that how that works?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, the carriers, you know, is a competitive market, so the carriers are looking to offer what the best they can and still, I guess, still make it work as far as the subsidies between the federal government and the state government. There are certain, when we certify, when we do the eligible telephone provider, there are certain things in the orders that the commission will put out that they have to provide a certain minimum amount of minutes or a certain minimum amount of text. So it's about kind of the standard right now, and the last one that went through the ETP process was 500 texts, 500 minutes.
So I'm still a little bit unclear about, is it a free phone or is it a subsidized phone?
Some,
it may get to your 17 versus a higher percentage.
In some cases, is a free phone. We have about 70,000 participants, and I might be off in that number because it does vary. And about two-thirds of them actually receive the free phone, with the other third receiving more traditional landline subsidy.
Okay. Senator?
How many carriers participate in this program? Is there a lot of competition to help get the price of these phones down, or how many, or do you just put out a bid? How does that process work?
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, there is about 29 carriers. Most of them are landline carriers. Some of them are small landline carriers like State or Silo. Some of them are the large carriers like CenturyLink, Frontier. On the cell phone side, the ones that are subsidized, that don't provide a free phone, there's only three of those. And then on the free phones, right now there's two. One has just left the market, so we have two providers, actually three providers, but one provider just does Tribal Lifeline, which is a little bit different.
Okay. Further? Anybody else? Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. That's all I had signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify? Oh, what? All right. Hold on. Representative, I'm sorry, I have one other person here. Chad Ludwig. Welcome.
Hello. Everyone, my name is Chad Ludwig. I am the president of the Oregon Association for the Deaf. I'm happy to be here today. I know almost everyone on this committee, so Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. I do have a few comments that I wanted to share with you today. This bill, 3268, we have been tracking since the beginning and initially strongly opposed it. But over the process, we have changed our position to neutral. So today, I just have some of our concerns that I'd like to bring up. I saw you ask the questions to the other people providing testimony today about media and marketing issues. I have lived in this state for 5 years now, and I've been a president of the Oregon Association of the Deaf for 4 years, and we serve deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind constituents, and that totals 175,000 people in the state. And we have not seen, and I just asked my team member here if we had seen any TV advertisements from any of those 29 companies or any commercials on TV, and we have not. We have not seen anything like that. We also have not seen any marketing materials that are targeted towards citizens with hearing loss to provide them access to the Lifeline program. And nothing with captions that provides them access to the Lifeline program. So that is one point that I wanted to make and something that I feel strongly about. Those companies need to increase their accessibility to reach out to the deaf and hard of hearing community. Also, as far as the sunset on the bill goes, there are two separate areas of language on the bill so that talk about sunsetting. One is about the OTAP and Lifeline program, and the second sunset is about the OTRS and ODAP programs. The language there proposes that it becomes a permanent program, and we would prefer to not make it a permanent program. We do want to maintain the current sunset on that bill. For the purposes of so that it would sunset in 2020, the original sunsets in 2020, right? And the current bill is saying that it wants to remove that sunset, and we do not want that sunset removed because we would like to have the opportunity to review and assess the program at that time. Also, as far as continuing the program or moving it to another department or shutting down the program, that will depend on what that future assessment indicates. The second thing is we recommend that the advisory committee is governed by the PUC and not by the governor. And I can explain more about that if you would like. Thirdly, it's my understanding that the FCC is going to be taking over the application verification process for Lifeline nationwide, including the state of Oregon. So it would be appropriate for the PUC to weigh in on the assessment of that program when that federal involvement begins. So I'm not sure what the point of this bill is to begin with when the FCC is going to be taking over it eventually. Also, on the FCC 16-38, which was adopted on March 31st, 2016, that's the citation as FCC 1638, yeah. Any questions?
Yes, Senator.
Chat, thanks for coming today. So why was your group against this originally?
Because at the beginning, they mistakenly included ODAP and OTRS in the language where they were fully shutting down the program. But that language has since been removed. So that's what changed our opinion. And then also we recommended that there were deaf and hard of hearing individuals on the committee, and that was fixed. So both of those issues were resolved.
Okay. Anybody else? Thank you very much.
Can he stay? She wants him to stay.
Hello.
Hi, again, for the record, I'm Melissa Kinnear, House District 46. Thank you for coming back. I wanted to try to address some of the questions, and I thought it would be helpful to have Chad here in case there's a conversation that should happen about the bill. I just want to say that originally when this bill, and I'm sorry that Martin Taylor's not here today, his final day at Care Oregon, and I was asking him some of these questions as the questions were coming up, and he's in the middle of a farewell party. So I'm sorry that he's the one that worked really hard on this. But I know that he learned a lot in this process. He knew that a lot of the states that run this program actually don't have a local state entity like the PUC run the program. They do it federally. And so originally what he thought was he would take that, I think it's 3.5 cents out of the 7 cents that is the Oregon share, because the other half is federal share, and he would say, well, let's take that off. People shouldn't have to pay that, and we'll just rely on the federal government. But he didn't realize, because he was not so aware of the whole how PUC and the Lions work, did not realize that by lopping off that money, he's actually eliminating the funding for the other two programs, which includes the hearing program for the deaf. So once he discovered that and got in the stakeholder group, they decided, okay, let's not change how it's managed by the PUC. Let's just figure out how to make sure that we can increase utilization. But my understanding during that process was that the deaf community wanted to remove the sunset and have their program permanently, so I was a little surprised by Chad's testimony, and it raises for me the question about two different directions to go. One is pass the bill as is, that sunset is, or removing the sunset's a long way off, you can always put it back on in the future, or should you send it to rules and correct that, because I'm just surprised. I thought that was something that they wanted out of this, so that's why I was hoping you could keep Chad here to respond to that.
Representative, as you know, every time the legislature meets, sunsets are available.
Yes, that's right. So you may want to keep it as is, and because they're a part of this conversation, it can, and the task, they're on the task force. And I am sympathetic to the fact that none of them had heard this. This is exactly one of the reasons that we want all stakeholders involved. And you had asked Michael about, you know, how to really increase eligibility. I think the CCOs are very interested in being involved, because certainly OHP and SNAP are the ways that you determine eligibility, and it's to the CCO's benefit to really have people to have access to them through the phones. The other thing that Martin had said when you were asking the question about are the phones free or subsidized, he said that if they're cell phones, they're free, and if they're landlines, they're subsidized.
So Representative, I the bill is a little confusing to me. I want to be sure that I understand this. The committee that this creates is advisory to the PUC?
Yes.
Okay, because they're making all their recommendations to the PUC.
Correct.
To improve the program.
Correct.
It's a little different that we have the governor appointing it if it's an advisory body to the PUC, but it is what it is, I guess. Other questions, Senator?
Can we do a virtual sunset?
Every time you sit down, there's a virtual sunset available.
A conceptual sunset?
Okay, Chair, may I add a comment?
Yes.
Okay, so for instance, the advisory committee, right now the bill asks that be placed under the office of the governor. So, but PUC has their own commission, and they have their own authority. and they have resources and access because they govern several other advisory committees. But this one's being sent to the governor's office, and that is something I'd like to figure out why that's happening. Why would it not be left under the PUC?
Chad, I think you're misreading the bill. If it looks to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the committee and the program stays with the PUC. So the committee is advisory to the Public Utility Commission, not to the governor. The governor just appoints the committee.
Yes. The PUC appoints people to several different advisory committees, but why are they not the ones appointing the members to this one? Because the PUC has access to those resources. Do you understand what I'm asking?
You would have to ask the representative sitting next to you.
Okay.
I mean, my basic response is that there was a big stakeholder group, which I understood them to be a part of, that came up with this structure. So I'm sorry, I'm not able to answer better than that.
Probably doesn't make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Great. Thank you. Well, anybody else wish to comment on this bill? Come on, Richard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Richard Kosasan with Verizon Wireless. I do not want to be a naysayer, but I think there's a few things that need to come out. If one were to take a look on page 3, section 2, subsection 3.
You're looking at the bill or an amendment?
The bill. Notwithstanding subsections 1 and 2, this section's money expended on marketing and outreach.
Hold on. Where are you at again?
Page 3. Excuse me. Page 3. And that would be subsection 3, lines 8 through 10. Monies expended on marketing and outreach activities under this section may not exceed 15% of monies collected as a surcharge under Section 7, Chapter 290, okay. Oregon Laws, 1987. So the program obviously has been around for years and years and years. The PUC has administered the program, and I believe the commission has done a very good job in terms of effectively and efficiently managed the program for the Lifeline program, as well as the telecommunications device access program, as well as the Oregon Telecommunications Relay Service program. But if you take 15% of a portion of the money for, quote, marketing and outreach, to me, long term, you're going to put pressure on the overall costs associated with the program, and the surcharge thus could go up. I think there's a better way to do that. The legislature already this session passed Senate Bill 84, and that brought in interconnected voice over internet protocol service to the residential service protection fund. And if one were to look at connections there, in Oregon there's probably 600,000 plus. At the current rate, at 84 cents a year, that would generate roughly $500,000. So if there was an effort for outreach, to me, I would earmark $100,000 or $200,000 out of those new dollars, say for a designated period of 12 months, 24 months, 36 months, whatever, and use those dollars specifically for that purpose with a cap on it and leave the existing program alone. Mr. Chair, thanks. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions, but I do believe there's a better way to address this.
So your concern is that 15% is too big a piece of the pie?
Well, I think it is, but this is a, I think it's a very worthwhile program. But if you look at eligibility, I think we've had recently perhaps some questions regarding the eligibility of certain people that are, quote, eligible for Medicaid or the Oregon Health Plan in the state of Oregon. So that, to me, is a question. But I think once we start a new program and earmark a portion of the dollars out of the traditional protection fund, there will be another program and another program and another program, and I think it puts long-term pressure on the overall fund.
Well, Richard, I would disagree with you. I don't think this is starting a new program. This is a program that's existed for a long time. I think the question that they're talking about is there's a belief by the sponsors that it hasn't been very well promoted to people who it's intended to serve. And I think all this is, how do you get there? Michael, you know.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Richard. So I don't know if you've thought about this, but regarding that 15%, I don't know what that 15% number would be, but what kind of number are you thinking about in terms of what would be an adequate promotional budget?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, as I mentioned, the RSPF has three different funds, and so there are three different budgets. The budget for the Oregon Lifeline is about $3 million. So when you look at 15% of $3 million, you can be as high as over $300,000. We do have, actually, we have a budget. Part of our budget in Oregon Lifeline is professional services, which are already budgeted. So that amount, if the committee had made a recommendation to the commission, because the recommendations by the committee will go through the commission for action, we're already budgeted for that. And so I don't think that's going to be an issue as far as is it going to really affect the surcharge? I would argue probably not. Can't say for sure. The Verizon representative is correct. That Senate Bill 84 is bringing VoIP in. That passed unanimously, both the Senate and the House. And we're looking at about, on the biennium, to bring in about $300,000 additional funds into the Residential Service Protection Fund. Our goal always has been to be good stewards of ratepayer money and to keep the surcharge as low as we can possibly keep the surcharge.
Well, when your money, anyway, the amount you spend is still subject to Ways and Means approval, isn't it?
Yes, it was part of our budget. We have a pipeline for a Residential Service Protection Fund that was approximately $9 million for the 2017-2019 biennium, and that had to be approved through Ways and Means, which it was, and was signed by the governor, our budget.
When that, you mentioned you had a line item in that for professional services, that would be approved by Ways and Means as
that
well.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, no, that's something we look at internally, where we budget as far as personal services and supplies. So we take the money that's approved by the legislature for that fund, and then we break it down. Now, actually, as you look through the budget, because we do a current service level budget, that amount's already in there. So Ways and Means technically are seeing that this amount is budgeted for this line item.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
All righty, we're going to need to confer. Let's close public hearing on this one, and we will move on. I'm missing a member. All right, so we will now move to, where are we at here?
Top two?
What group? Actually, we're right at the end, aren't we? So just, we have an announcement. We have HB 2975A on deck. That has to deal with what we heard last week, which is damages for... what is it, title search. We are not going to move that bill. We are going to hold that one over, and Representative Riley has agreed to do a work group on that during the interim. There are a number of issues that we need to take care of with that. He raised some good concerns, and I think we want to deal with that, but there's some issues that I think we want to work through, and it's not quite ready to move. So
and
we will not move that today.
And I think Representative Malmstrom will work with me on that.
Yes, that's my understanding. All righty. So then we have, is there anybody here who needed to talk on HB 3305? That was the travel trailers. No one wants to do travel trailers? Does anybody want to move travel trailers?
No.
Okay, so we're not going to move on that. So we're down to, where is the other vote?
Why don't you move it to rules and let him fix it?
Huh?
Why don't you move it to rules?
No, it isn't going to get any better there. You either want to support it or you don't.
You buy guitar. Move it. Your guitar. Move it at the rules.
Are you?
I'm okay.
You're okay? Are you okay?
I'm going to vote no.
You're a no. He's a no.
Rod went to dinner.
We're in... let's go recess for a few moments.
I think he went to dinner. Have to
3268A, the chair moves the dash three amendments, A3 amendments to House Bill 3268A. Opposition to that? Discussion? There's none. The dash threes are adopted. Chair moves House Bill 3268A as amended by the dash A3 amendments to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion? Discussion?
Discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be a no. I heard some testimony from Chad in the deaf community that they wanted a two-year or 2020 sunset. I don't think they got that, so I'll be a no in the committee and might, like I do often, change my mind on the floor.
A couple of times.
Yeah, a couple of times.
Yeah, he does change his mind.
He just likes to be beat up. So gives him a chance to be beat up.
I'm still trying to figure out a need for the bill. I understand the sunset part of it, but the rest of it, I just don't see a need for. So I'm a no.
Thank you, Senator. Anybody else? I would indicate that I'm going to support it, although I have some reluctance to it. Frankly, I've always thought that the responsibility to promote this really rests with Department of Human Services, since it's their clients are the ones who benefit from this. But that's never worked very well. And the fact that our participation rate is substantially lower than other states, probably is worthwhile the effort to make the service available. We authorized it. We ought to try and make it there. So I will support this. Going to watch it, though, Michael, because I'm skeptical. But we'll give it a shot. No votes? I know I had two, so...
I'm good.
You're good? You're good? All right, so House Bill, whatever the number is. God darn it. 3268A, as amended by the Dash 3s, moves to the floor of the Senate with a do-pass recommendation. Senators Girard and Thompson in opposition, and I will carry the bill. With that, we will close, and... I think that's it, isn't it?
Yeah. When's the party, House Chair?
I was just asking the Vice Chair when he had scheduled the party, and he didn't have it figured out yet.
I know. It is the duty of the Vice Chair to come up with that. Right.
It is. He was.
Don't worry about having it at Fred's house again.
I'm going to let you work that out. Members, thank you all. It's been a good session. As had become our routine, we moved a lot of legislation. You all did a really good job, and I appreciate that. And
great committee. It was fun.
We worked well together. So we are adjourned. Fun.